Hi, and welcome back to the She Mentors podcast. My name is Ali Aidy, and I'm the founder of She Mentors. Lovely to have you here with us today. For those of you who are new to She Mentors, we are a mentoring community for women in business who want to help each other succeed. So everyone in our community gives back 1 hour each month to someone else, and we call this the Mentor Hour. If you are intrigued by this concept, which I hope you are, then you can jump over to shementors.com.au and you can check us out. In today's podcast episode, we're talking about Islamophobia. We have two guests on the show, Saliha Iqbal and Saraya Sultan, who are both Muslim women working here in Australia. We talk about discrimination, microaggression, white feminism, and what workplaces can do to encourage and support more diverse talent. Let's dive straight into the interview. Welcome to the She Mentors podcast. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, how's it going?
This is the first time we've got two people on the podcast, so there might be a few of these like little hesitations before answering, so I'll try and direct it to each of you. So this podcast series particularly is around discrimination, and we want to use the She Mentors platform, both the membership and the podcast, to sort of raise awareness around this topic and educate and inform our listeners as well. So shall we start with just a short introduction on each of you? Saraya, do you want to go first, just and tell people who you are and what you do?
So first of all, I kind of would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land in which we are meeting today. I want to pay my respects to the elders, past, present and emerging. And the reason as well I'm doing this is because Melbourne is actually the fifth city that I've been lucky to have called home. So I have moved around a lot throughout my time, and I am extremely grateful to be able to actually set up a new home in this country. Setting up a new life here. So just a little bit about myself and kind of a little bit my journey as to where it's led me to Australia, essentially. So as I say, I've lived in 5 different countries, starting off with starting my childhood back in the village in Malaysia, where I grew up till I was 10 years old, being raised by a single mom, and pretty much the epitome of being raised by a village, because we grew up with my grandmother, my uncles and aunties and everything in the same village. And then my mom got remarried and she plucked me and moved me to Scotland, Edinburgh, Scotland, where there was a massive, culture shock to my system, where I kind of spent my teen years and my university years pretty much being a Muslim Malaysian in Scotland, which was, always a very interesting and exciting time for me. When I was at university, I was also given the opportunity to actually study in Cairo, because I studied Arabic at university. So I spent 6 months living in Cairo, which was, I think, as I would say, it is something that really pushed my maturity. So, if you ever want to feel like you want to grow up, go and live in a different country where you know nothing about and just throw yourself in and just, immerse yourself in it. And then from there on, I moved to London to start my professional career. And I decided before my 30th birthday that had enough of London, so hey, let's go and travel to Australia and come to Australia and live and enjoy, the lifestyle that Australia has got to offer. And it was supposed to only be a 2-year trip, but then I ended up finding my partner and now settling into this country. So throughout this time, the whole point of kind of me telling that story is that throughout this whole journey, having lived in many, many different countries, I find myself being very, very good at assimilating and adapting in all these different countries in order to kind of be part of the guys, being part of the culture, wanting to mix in with all my friends, obviously, and also wanting to, get a job and things like that. I've definitely become very good at kind of, I guess, assimilating is kind of probably the best word for it. But at the same time, thanks to my mom, my amazing mom, I've always kind of had this part of me that always wanted to maintain my Malaysian cultural heritage as well as my Muslim religion, in order to kind of, make sure that it's part of my identity as well and continue to uphold that and, maintain that part of it. Especially because my mom is very big, she's very big in the Scottish Malaysian community. Pretty much everyone who you know, comes to study from Malaysia to Scotland will know who she is. It's incredible. So that's kind of been part of my journey. My journey in the last couple of, years of me being in Australia has been about, you know, how do I become a leader? But also now I'm settling down is how do I want to bring up my family, I guess, you know, and I'm ensuring that I maintain that cultural identity a little bit and making sure that I pass that one down to my children. Yeah.
Fascinating story. Absolutely love that you've lived in all those countries. Such good experience that you got.
Yeah, it's I think anyone who's like never moved to a different country, even if it's just for a while, I would definitely highly recommend it. It's it will open your eyes in many different ways that you never realized before.
Yeah. I'm actually not from here either. I left London to go traveling around the world and then ended up in Australia, as you do, like backpacking, and then I was just like, I love it here. Like, it's so different from the rat race in London and like just so hectic kind of pace of life, and then you come here and it's just like, it's just beautiful country as well. Like, and then 9 years now I've been here, so yeah, now I'm kind of like really settled in, but I don't think I'm gonna go back now, so I think I'm here, permanent resident. Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah. What about you, Saliha?
My story is nowhere near as hectic or interesting as that. I'm 22. Before I start, I'd like to acknowledge that I'm recording on Bidjigal land by the Eora Nation. I always do an acknowledgement of country before all my recordings, and I'd like to do that today as well.
Yeah, great.
And just recognise that we are recording on stolen land. Yeah, no, I was born here in Australia. I'm 22. I haven't travelled yet. So I have nothing to add on that. But just to talk a little bit about myself, yeah, so I'm 22. I work in the media. I only finished my journalism degree like March this year. So I'm fresh out of uni. I work for a small youth publisher where I write articles typically around pop culture, news, opinion pieces. I freelance a lot for quite a few different companies. I also... at the moment, I'm hosting my own podcast called Here's the Thing, Though, where I talk a lot about kind of political stuff that's happening every day, a lot of introspective things about just being, I think, a person of colour, a woman of colour particularly, in Australia, and I discuss kind of a lot of my experiences in relation to the world and what's happening. Yeah, I'm Muslim. It's been a huge part of... I'm Pakistani and I'm Muslim, and it's been a huge part of my identity growing up. I think I've been wearing a hijab since I was like 10 years old. So it's really shaped the way that I interact with Australian society, for better or worse. So, yeah, I guess I'm here on this podcast today to talk a little bit about, like, my experiences being a hijab-wearing Muslim and, like, how that kind of is definitely a very particular experience in Australia.
Mm. Yeah, tell us all about it.
Early on, it was all right. I actually started wearing hijab when I went to a Muslim private school when I was younger. So I was very in the Muslim community. You know, I wasn't really exposed to a lot of the wider Australian society. I don't think I'd ever talked to like a white person until I was like 11, which is just because I was in like a really tight community. And, you know, it's like from a very particular, I guess, area. And then I kind of moved out because I used to live in like Western Sydney. And I moved kind of further in and started to meet a more diverse range of people, and that's kind of when the racism started, sadly enough. Wearing a hijab for me initially was perhaps, maybe I didn't really understand what I was doing, I was pretty young, but it was just like everybody was doing it and I wanted to wear a hijab too. And then like as I grew up, I kind of started to realize like the baggage that comes with that and like how much it really impacts your relationship with Australia, because initially maybe it wasn't a big deal and I didn't really think so much about my Australian identity. It wasn't like something that ever really came up, especially when I was around like a lot of other Pakistani people. You know, I didn't really ever have to justify myself in any capacity. But then I started to kind of meet other Australian people and it starts to become more like, so where are you from? Where are you really from? And suddenly like all my suddenly I was just denied like this Australian identity that like was inherently mine anyway, but because other people don't perceive you as being from here because you're not like white enough or whatever, it really changes, because honestly I don't really see myself as Australian some of the time, and it's not, which is strange because I literally have never been anywhere else. Like I've traveled maybe like once for like 2 weeks or something. Like, I haven't really been anywhere. Like, this is my home and it's all I know. And yet there really isn't that sense of, like, being Australian or belonging, because, like, I don't really know what that means anymore, because people have really decided what their own perceptions of being Australian are, and I don't really fit into it and I don't really care about it, because it's like, I mean, being Australian is a concept anyway, because it's not like you guys are Indigenous, you know what I mean? Like, being Australian is a concept. Mm-hmm. It's not like, you're not, doesn't mean anything. If you live here, you live here. Like, but yeah, look, there's a lot of identity conversations we can have around that. But yeah, I feel like growing up in hijab for me was like, it made me grow up a lot faster, because you're suddenly held to a higher standard than everybody else around you, expected to uphold a minority that nobody else is really expected to. You're just completely denied your individuality, and suddenly you're a voice for, like, a very vast, very diverse group where you obviously cannot represent everybody. And you're just, like, hyper aware about how you're constantly representing yourself and your community. So I feel like for me, wearing a hijab, like, really pushed me to grow up. It also actually pushed me, I think, into a lot of leadership positions, funnily enough. Just, like, I mean, in high school and, like, kind of growing up, I was definitely doing a lot of volunteer work, a lot of local council leadership stuff. But I think it's because I just, like, really wanted to prove myself a little bit, because, like, people make a lot of assumptions about you. And I really just kind of wanted to prove my right to be here, which in hindsight now I think is kind of sad. Like, in the moment I was doing really great things. I mean, wonderful resume builders. Like, it was fantastic. But, you know, like, in hindsight, I'm just like, I don't know how much I was doing all that stuff because I loved it, or because, like, I was just really striving for a form of, like, acceptance and belonging, and, like, people actually seeing me as, like, a person who cares about things and not just, like, my look or my identity. So I feel like perhaps wearing a hijab and being treated as, like, that Muslim girl and nothing else really pushed me into a lot of situations where I was talking a lot and, like, doing a lot of volunteer work and kind of just trying to make a name for myself in some ways, because I just didn't want to be brushed aside like that. Hmm. And now here I am.
Soraya, so, like, nodding along as well. Like, do you relate to a lot of the things?
Yeah, 100%. I think from my side, it's kind of mainly, you know, coming from an immigrant child, you know, from another country into, you know, a new society, I definitely was like, I am going to make my mark. You know, I certainly had a little bit of that. You know, I'm going to show these people, you know, I'm capable of doing all of these things, you know, tick, 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 tick. So, yeah, my, you know, I think my experience is slightly different from Samiha in the fact that I chose not to wear a hijab. So growing up in Malaysia, it was always a choice. For us, you know, some of my cousins do, some of my cousins don't. My mom, probably up to, I think now she's only chosen to wear hijab now, but throughout kind of her pretty much most of her adult life, she was, you know, she was happy not to wear it, because it was just, it's always been a choice to us, you know, back home. So that was never something that, and I just kind of chosen myself to remain not to wear it, and maybe later on in my life, I might choose then to wear it. But that's kind of, you know, I like the fact that I think I've always had that choice with my family. So I've had a slightly different experience in terms of when talking about my religion, because people are actually always surprised when I tell them I'm Muslim, even though my name, you know, I think even with my name, they're always like, I think the way that I've been. And when I grew up, I was involved in dance. I was involved in dance a lot. I was I was involved in ballet, jazz, contemporary, like, you know, performing arts school. I then became a competitive cheerleader throughout my university. You know, so I was very kind of, in terms of, I was out with, you know, the girls and things like that. I never addressed quite, I guess, not provocatively in any way, but I do dress quite freely the way that I want to dress, because, you know, part of me, fashion was my statement as well. So there's been conversations come up in terms of, you know, because I'll be going to cheerleading practice and I'll be fasting because it's Ramadan, and people will be like, what? Like, what? Why are you fasting, you know? Or then even throughout high school, you know, when I'll be a bit slow at school because it's Ramadan, because, you know, it's... I would be a bit tired, And the teachers would be like a bit concerned, oh, you're not eating, you're not drinking. And I'm like, no, I'm completely fine. You know, this is what we do. I'm healthy, like I'm fine. And so I've had to, I think I've, in terms of my ways of growing up Muslim, it was more that people were surprised. You know, I had a bit of a, there's always a bit of surprise when I'm like, oh, I'm Muslim. They're like, oh, really? You know, and I think that, yeah, it was always a bit odd for me. And I kind of have to then justify that, yes, I'm allowed to look like this and be Muslim too, you know.
Yeah, you don't fulfill the oppressed stereotype. Yes. They're like, you sure, hon? Yes. You don't look like you need saving, though.
Exactly.
Saliha, you mentioned the like assumptions people make about you. Can you talk about like what are these assumptions that people make about you and how do they make you feel?
I think it probably aligns a little bit with Saraya as well. The number one thing is how surprised people are when they get to know me, because I'm quite opinionated, have a lot of political opinions, have a degree, you know, I'm interested in things and I learn about it, I research it. I mean, I'm a journalist, it's part of my job. And people are always like really surprised that I'm like articulate and like interested in politics and like interested in good. Yeah, Soraya's laughing at articulate. I know. I'm sure like most people of color have heard that. Wow, you're so articulate.
You like inherit so well.
Yeah. The inherent surprise that like we can be smart, I think, is one of them. Which like, I mean, maybe it feels a bit weird to be like, yeah, I'm smart. Like it feels like a bit up yourself, but like people really expect me to be like uneducated. Which frustrates me because they've obviously got assumptions of what they think Muslim women are. And I think that a lot of people think Muslim women are like these quiet, oppressed little minority group that like, you know, is being jailed by their, you know, patriarchal like family or whatever. There's like this real Rapunzel image that people have of you locked away in your tower, can't really interact with friends, can't go out, can't, you know, like learn about things that I want to learn about, can't like... People are always surprised that I did like, you know, arts and like media at uni. They're like, well, your parents were okay with that? And I'm like, yeah, why wouldn't they be? Like, you know, the assumption that like my parents either must have wanted me to be a doctor or nothing, as if that like is a universal experience for Muslim women. I don't know. But there's definitely like a lot of assumptions just on like the meek, like oppressed kind of Muslim girl that people expect you to be. Probably largely due to the media, I imagine, and like representations of Muslim women on TV. And then they get to know you. And like for me, I'm like I said, quite loud, quite opinionated, quite unafraid of conflict. and it's quite jarring for some people. But what I don't like is it often becomes the, oh, you're not like other Muslim girls trope. And it really does bother me because it's like, I'm not the exception to the rule. My life isn't the exception to other Muslim women. There are plenty of Muslim women just like me. Like, I'm not in the minority of my community. There are so many other smart, educated, loud, opinionated Muslim women that are out there, like, changing the world. And if you don't see that, like, you're probably choosing to ignore them because we're everywhere. We're everywhere. Like, go to your local community meeting. I guarantee you there's a hijabi woman there. Like, we're so involved in our communities and in our politics because that is actually, like, people forget that that really impacts our lives. Like if you're going to be a Muslim woman, especially a hijab wearing Muslim woman, because you are openly quite visibly Muslim in Australia, like our Australian politics impact us quite greatly because Islamophobia is on the rise in our politics and people are always debating our right to migrate here. People are debating our right to cover up. People are debating, you know, what isn't appropriate for us, talking for us constantly, but not to us. So you'd actually be surprised, you shouldn't be, but people will be surprised that, like, Muslim women are really vocal in our communities. We are because, like, we have to be because everyone's trying to talk for us. And we're, like, out here trying to be, like, actually, hello, I'm here. I'm a real person with a real voice that I want to use. Listen to me. You know, my grandma, she passed away recently, but she was, like, really vocal in her local community. She's, like, 5'4", maybe even, like, 4'11". She's very small. Small Pakistani woman in her like shalwar kameez and her traditional clothes. She would always go to her community meetings. She was always like doing, she started her own like Pakistani Women's Association. Like she was always being vocal for her like group of people. And I feel like a lot of Muslim women are, but it's just assumptions about us for the people who don't know any Muslim women. Yeah. It's like you haven't bothered to like get to know any of us, and then you've like made all these assumptions.
Mm. Yeah.
Like it's not real.
Yeah. And I think it's important to pick on the fact that when people make the assumptions and then you do break those stereotype of assumptions, then they become almost like, we can't deal with this. We can't compete with it. You know, and therefore they're not breaking down the barriers to then be like, okay, well, you know, there are people, obviously women who are opinionated, who are not oppressed in the stereotype way in every way possible. Yeah. You know, but it's almost like when you then come up to then show that you're not oppressed and you're not all these things, and people are then being like, okay, well, we don't want to touch it. We don't want to deal with this. We don't want to then, you know, kind of, because they're being too loud now. People are being too loud. People are speaking out too much, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Then it's kind of becoming like, it's an aggressive movement instead of an actual conversation that we should be having.
God, if I had a dollar for every time somebody called me aggressive for like doing the absolute bare minimum to stick up for myself, I'd be rich.
Yeah.
I listened to your podcast, Aliha, on your first one that you did, and it really made me smile at the end where you were like, you know, everyone talks about wanting to be at the table and have a seat at the table, and you were like, and I just want to burn the table. Yes. And I really like smiled because I thought, you know what, that's one of the reasons that so many women, especially in our community, leave the corporate world, because they don't want to sit at the table. They don't want any part in that. And like, yes, we get called aggressive all the time as women in business for standing up for what we believe and actually like, you know, contradicting someone in power. And so I really loved your podcast because I feel like...
I'm so glad.
I really did. I thought that it was fascinating. I think everyone that listens to this podcast, you must go and check it out. So it's called This Is
The Thing. So my podcast is called Here's The Thing Though. And this episode in particular is called White Feminism.
Yeah. I think this is exactly what we do need to listen to. And you being passionate about it comes through, but I think in a really positive, likeable way, because you absolutely have to have a voice and you have to say what you think and you have to try and evoke change. And I think, yeah, you've got to go and listen to it because I absolutely love it. Have you listened to it, Soraya?
Yeah, I've listened all the way up, and my favorite is definitely the latest one because
you like it.
Yeah, I was like, oh, it's my childhood.
This is the thing, right? You by having a podcast episode, you're reaching so many people that relate to you. And this is why we're having this conversation as well, is because by doing that, you're empowering other women to speak out and stand up for themselves and to not accept the status quo, which is the whole.
Yeah. Something that was really, because we like, I mean, my partner and I just started the podcast. Like, I didn't really have
a huge...
Yeah, Mitch is my partner.
Because you know what?
Yeah, he's my partner.
He's so funny in it because he's like the quiet, like chilled out one. Then he just like reels you in.
Yeah, I'm like all over the place and I'm like angrily screaming about things. And he just like has a really good way of like, without actually, it's not like he's coming in and taking over. It's very subtle, but like pushes me in the right direction. No, he's great. This is very much our real life dynamic as well.
Yeah.
I'm like the angry, slightly unhinged one. And he's like the gentle like super chill.
he really makes me smile.
So we started that podcast. It's actually his idea, funnily enough. It's actually his idea of the podcast. We started it together and it was kind of a pretty small thing. Like, I didn't really have a social media following at the time or anything like that, and it's crazy how much it's like blown up because so many people, especially a lot of other women of color, have like messaged me and been like, oh my god, like everything you're talking about, I have experienced, and I've never seen somebody like put a name to it like that. Like, now I have the tools to like actually call it out, because I didn't know what this was before, and it just was something that happened to me, and now I'm realizing how like universal it is, because it is. Like, I feel like, I think especially for women of color, and particularly like even Muslim women, but women of color in general, like we really obviously lack a lot of representation in all aspects of the community, be it in the media, be it wherever. But also, like, when we do kind of get mentioned or we do kind of have someone talking about us, it's usually not somebody that we relate to. Like, I find, you know, for example, this is a very small example, but, like, even just, like, I was saying earlier with Muslim women on TV and on the media and how, like, they often are characters and things that are written by non-Muslims, and they are often written within the stereotype, so they're still not relatable to me. And if anything, it's bad because it just, like, further alienates me to people's perception of Islam and religion. So I feel like there's a real gap of women of color talking to each other about our own experiences, because people are always talking for us. And so I feel like that's why this podcast, despite, I mean, we've got like 6 episodes out now or something, so not that many. We've only been doing it for 6 weeks essentially. And it's really like blown up a bit, and it's so sweet getting like messages from other women of color who are just like, yes, girl, like I get you. I feel you right now. It's so good, because I feel like we have a lot of the same, like, similar experiences, and like, no matter what, it's not even about what culture you're from. Like, as long as you're like kind of a non-white woman, you've probably had these experiences, and a lot of white women also have these experiences. So it's really interesting. It's just like, how many things, these are just like conversations that like I have with Mitch, my partner, all the time. And he was the one who was kind of like, we should make a podcast.
Yes.
And I'm so glad we did, because like, these are literally just conversations that we like have, but we've just started recording them and maybe research them slightly a little bit more than we would in a conversation.
Mm-hmm. I really want to get into the white feminism part of this discussion as well, because I think it's really relevant to what you're saying. So before we do get into that, should we just cover off for both of you, what types of religious discrimination have you had, either just in your own lives or in the workplace specifically, as this podcast is for women in business, but your experiences are relevant really regardless of that. Soraya, do you want us to go first?
So in terms of workplace, I've actually been very lucky that I've never felt any discrimination, you know, in terms of my religion or my race. Even I think part of it is because, you know, Edinburgh is quite multicultural and London is very multicultural. Like, you know, when you work in London, there is just, I do feel that it's not really, it's, I think there's sometimes just more ethnic people in organizations than they are actually white people in some organizations, because it's just kind of how, you know, it is.
Soraya,
yes,
I also agree with that, it's very multicultural, but there is an ethnicity pay gap of about 20%.
Okay.
20%. That's a lot.
Wow. Yeah. To be honest, I wasn't kind of aware of that actually.
Yeah, there is. And so it's interesting that, yes, I also thought that it's not really an issue in the UK when you're working in like the media, and I'm from a publishing background, and it was really multicultural, and you didn't really blink twice if there was 100 different people at the table. But there is an ethnicity pay gap of about 20%. According to research. So it's interesting. And I guess this is another thing I want to talk to you about, is it's not published here in Australia. Like, what is, so we talk about the gender pay gap a lot on this podcast and in the membership, which is at 14% in Australia, but that doesn't take into account ethnicity, and there's a definite pay gap there. So
yeah, I talked about that recently in my podcast as well. I'm going to go on like a 30-second tangent. I mentioned that in my podcast on white feminism, because part of the thing that we mentioned was like, you know, people really talk about the pay gap a lot, but it doesn't account for the fact that women of color get paid less than white women. So the pay gap talks about the highest pay rate of women, which is white women. We will get into it when we talk about white feminism, but I just wanted to put that out there. That's probably a really good example of white feminism, is that we're often, as women of color, left out of the stats for like the discrimination that women go through, because there isn't really an acknowledgement in that kind of feminism that there's an intersectionality in discrimination, and that people like me or Soraya will feel more discrimination than like a white woman, because it's not just about gender, it's about everything. All the intersections.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I guess that's something, you know, I definitely need to kind of educate myself a little bit more on, and kind of do a little bit more research, definitely. But in terms of kind of personally, I think it's because I've always been assimilating myself. So therefore, I've never, I guess, maybe not really made myself notice these things, because I've been too busy trying to adapt and too busy trying to impress and too busy trying to assimilate, because I wanted, you know, to do well in my job. So, and I guess this is like small little things. So, you know, when we're talking about, I guess, culture, you know, people always talk about, this is the work culture we want to have, you know, we want to have a very open culture and diverse culture and things like that. But when it actually comes to actually culture, like, you know, people are talking about when they want to go on a Friday night drinks, they want to go Friday night drinks, you know, and that was always kind of like a little bit where I'm like, well, you know, it's not really my thing, you know, I don't want to go out to a pub and get drunk, because I don't drink. So, you know, I'm more than happy to go and sit and, you know, like get coffee, or actually have dinner with people, but, you know, going out on a Friday night drinks is just not my thing. And sometimes people are like, that's, you know, our culture, you know, that's how we get together and you know, get to know each other, is actually just going out, going down to the pub and get drunk. And, you know, it's never that someone, you know, a Muslim person is, you know, who chooses not to drink, is not going to feel either comfortable. I never feel comfortable about doing it. I don't mind going out maybe for one mocktail, you know, to have that, but it's not really something that I'm interested in. And there's a lot of things about culture, I guess, that doesn't really kind of ask the whole community that you're working with. It's always about what is, you know, what's the fun things doesn't really include be inclusive in all the different cultures and all the different diversity. And I know you can't include every single thing, but I think it's important to start having those conversations when you're talking about, you know, a workplace and how to make it more inclusive and how to make it more equitable for people. Because when you're building a diverse and inclusive culture, you actually got to include everybody and not just say, let's have a Friday night drink and everybody can join us, you know, because some people are not going to want to do that. So, yeah. Yeah, and I think the other part of me in terms of, I guess, the other thing that I've noticed is, especially during Ramadan. So Ramadan's a big thing, you know. We fast for a whole month, and from sunrise to sundown, we don't eat or drink, you know, and we practice patience, and it's what we do. And, you know, it's something that's, you know, that's really important to me. And it is a constant every year I'll have to explain it to everyone at work, like, hey guys, you know, like I'm not, you know, this is how it's for the whole month, we're back, you know, we're going to Ramadan. I always kind of pre-warn people, just because they're like, you usually move at 150%, but at Ramadan maybe I move at like 99%, so, you know, I'm not quite, you know, 150%. So because I'm taking a little break for myself, I'm taking a seat back, and I'm using this time to kind of, you know, reboot myself as well. And I actually find a really, something that I've actually just want to point out here, that the Richmond Tigers, I think does really, really well with, and I think it's a bit of a promo thing with them, to be honest, but Bashir Huli, who's, you know, he's Muslim. I do love when he's like, you know, they kind of like put it out on there when he's having a game, he's just gone to pray, or he's just gone, you know, to do all these little things. And I love it, because they're just like making it like they're showing that, like, you know, we're being really inclusive of this, you know, making sure that he's able to train during Ramadan and things like that. So I think there needs to be a little bit more recognition with that. Sorry.
Yeah, well, it's just like, it's normalizing us, right? I love when, like, yeah, things like that, where, like, you'll be watching something and they'll be like, yeah, he's just going to go and pray. And I'm like, oh my God, people know we pray. Because it's just, no, I have really similar, yeah. So I totally get, like, most of my workplaces, I mean, I'm fresh out of uni, so I haven't been in many workplaces. I have been pretty good, because I work for, like, a small company. My boss is Indian, so we have, like, a lot in common like that. He's very understanding. For me, it's not so much outright discrimination that I have faced at work, though I know people who have. You know, I've never been, you know, called bad things or, like, been racially stereotyped like that. But definitely probably the two that come to mind are, like, the really kind of, like, microaggression stuff that can happen at work, the microaggressions, and, yeah, inclusivity. I'll start with inclusivity first. Yes, I completely agree with, like, drinking culture. I find that quite frustrating, actually, because while I'm, like, happy to go with friends to wherever and they drink and I don't, I do that with my friends because I like them enough to do that with them. Do I want to go with my workplace to drink when I'm not going to drink and I'm just going to sit there while everybody else gets drunk? No, I don't want to. Sorry, not interested. I'll do it, like, if I really like my coworkers and I want to hang out with them. But it's frustrating that, like, and this is just an Australian thing there, like, the drinking culture is so intense. For somebody who's never drank in my life, it's not fun. And there's definitely not an understanding of that in general. I think when you're Muslim, like, there's not an understanding that there are certain things that I don't want to do or don't want to take part in or don't have an interest in because I'm Muslim. For me, I work in writing and publishing, so I write a lot of articles. Like, it's just little things. Like, hey, Saliha, could you write this, like, article on this alcohol thing that, like, I'm supposed to sell this alcohol to somebody? And I'm like, I don't know what it tastes like. I don't know what alcohol tastes like. I don't know what even it feels like to, I don't know how to sell this to somebody. I don't know. Like, and they're like, and then there's, like, a frustration because I don't know these things. But it's like, I'm sorry, your experiences aren't universal to me. and sometimes it's like, it's frustrating that people get frustrated that their experiences are not universal to me. Like, it's like, oh, why can't you just write it? I'm like, look, I can write it for you. I just can't guarantee it to be good because I don't know what the hell I'm writing about right now. And it's things like that. Like, something else that I find frustrating is like an expectation to be like openly sexual sometimes. So like, I might be recording with somebody on like, because it's different. Like, I don't mind having a chat with the girlfriends, but when I'm in a professional setting or like I'm doing a podcast or something like that, I get really frustrated when I get asked about like my relationship with my partner or like intimate questions that it's normally a fun gal chat, but like I am representing my community and I don't have the individuality that white women are afforded. When you talk about your sex life, you can do that and it's not going to reflect anything on other white women. I can't do that because Muslim people are going to get upset and think I'm talking about their community, which, because you guys are going to perceive me as doing that. You know, like, I don't have the freedom of individuality and there isn't really a lot of understanding of that. So it's frustrating because it's like, I'll have a off-the-record conversation with you about whatever sex thing you want to talk about. But I don't want to do this on, like, a podcast that's being published because there are other Muslim people that are going to listen to it and feel defensive because they're going to think that I am representing all Muslims like that. Because you know what? Other people are going to think I'm representing all Muslims like that. And I, you know, there isn't really an understanding of that nuance of like the fact that everything is conditional for me. Like, I don't have the freedom in this Australian society to just do whatever I want and not be reflected in my community because Australians are going to reflect whatever I say back on my community. And I do find it really frustrating when I'm asked to do certain things that are like not typical in Islamic culture, like talking about drinking or talking about certain sexual things that like, I'll have a convo with you about it off the record, but like, I don't want my name on this in a public setting. I don't want to write an article for work on like certain things because it's just going to like make it more difficult for me to retain a relationship with my community. And I don't need that. And it's not worth it for me. So I feel like, yeah, there's really a lack of understanding on like the nuances of existing as a Muslim person in Australia, especially a hijab wearing Muslim woman. People are not empathetic or compassionate about that. And it's always like, what, you're just a bad feminist, you know? Or things like that, because I don't want to talk about a certain topic. And it's like, there is a plethora of women you could ask to talk about this. You know, like there is a plethora of women that would love to talk about this with you. It doesn't have to be me. I have certain elements of feminism that I want to talk about, that I'm good at talking about, that I'm equipped to talk about, and that people want to hear me talk about. And I'll do that. But it does frustrate me, the expectation that my feminism isn't perfect because it isn't like this image of white feminism, because I'm not discussing levels of sexual liberation, because I'm not discussing all these things. Like, the understanding of my feminism becomes flawed, as if there aren't different things that people talk about and experience. Like, some of these are not relevant to my life and I don't want to talk about them on the record, you know? So I feel like that, because that comes with microaggressions then, right? There's like little comments about like, oh, well, like, do you believe in like, like, are you okay with women having sex before marriage? Like, do you think that's sin? And it's like, oh my God, no. And like, people are always like, also, do you think people are going to go to hell for doing this? And I'm like, are you seriously asking me that right? No, of course. What, who do you think I am? I'm like, there's this real lack of understanding. I think it's because of like white perceptions of feminism, autonomy and individuality. Like, I think in white societies and individualistic societies where there is a sense of collectivism, like, there isn't really an understanding of, oh, but just, you know, they're, oh, just do what you want, though. It doesn't matter who you upset. And I'm like, okay, like, I get that you live your life like that, but I can't do that. It's not an option for me. And I don't want to do that. Like, I care about my audience. I care about my Muslim community, which is very diverse with a lot of differing opinions. And I'm kind of trying to, like, not get in trouble with them, like, a little bit. And I feel like people get really, that is, like, a really controversial thing to say in white circles. Because they're like, oh, so you're oppressed. And I'm like, no, 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 that's not what, I don't think that word means what you think it means. Like, there's a real lack of understanding that I can be myself and be liberated, quote unquote. You know, I can be empowered in whatever way I want to be in. And just because it's not the same way that you want to express yourself doesn't mean I'm now oppressed. Like, my religion does impact a lot of my life and I try to live by that. And that means that I say no to certain opportunities. And I just feel like it's crazy the like moral assumptions people make on you because of that. Like, without a complete lack of understanding of your context, about the fact that, look, until we have more Muslim women in Australian media, I am a niche representative right now. So I gotta do what I can to please the masses of Muslims. until you, like, if you want me to talk about more controversial things, have more Muslim women on, because there's power in numbers for us. Otherwise, I'm just a target. And, like, I'm going to do what I can to protect myself from, like, the vitriolic hate that I kind of already will get on a regular basis. Like, there just seems to be no understanding of that. People expect you to self-sacrifice for them constantly on the basis of, like, liberation and, like, empower yourself. I'm like, honey, there's nothing empowering about getting 100 trolls every fucking day. Like, I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to put my situation into that. Like, that's the, like, people really expect me to sacrifice that. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to get trolls for you. I'm not going to do that for you. And the fact that I'm expected to do that so you can fulfill your own woke feminist fantasy is not going to happen. Like, so yeah, there's definitely, I find it really frustrating, not overt racism, but just like the expectations of, like, of me having to prove how feminist I am because I wear a hijab, so I'm already assumed as, like, oppressed in some fashion. So I need to prove how liberated I am. I need to prove how feminist I am. I need to prove how, you know, progressive, quote unquote, I am. And I have to do it constantly. And if I decide not to do it because the pros don't really outweigh the cons here, like, then there's a moral assumption made about me. That is really frustrating because people don't take into account that I walk a very fine line as a Muslim woman in the media, that I'm going to get trolls on the best of days. And I'm not about to, like, do things that are going to make that worse for me because I'm, like, 22. Like, I, yeah. You know, I'm just fresh out of uni and, like, I'm just trying to, like, navigate my life and I don't want to make it harder for myself, and that is seen as, like, selfish all the time, but it's just an act of self-preservation. And we really got to normalize self-preservation for Muslim women more, because nobody really acknowledges that we're getting hate from all sides. You know, like, I'm gonna get racism from, like, white people, and I'm gonna get misogyny from white men in particular, and I'm gonna get gaslit from white women who don't think my feminism is inclusive of them. Lol. And then I'm gonna get, you know, Muslim people being like, actually, I don't believe what you said and you're representing me, therefore I'm upset with you now because I feel like you have misrepresented the community, even though I'm not representing the community, but I'm perceived that way. And there's, like, so many different things that I gotta navigate as a Muslim hijab wearing woman in the media, and it's like no one is really understanding of that, and it frustrates me. And then if we're gonna go back to workplaces, then there's, you know, yeah, so the assumption of doing certain things that I don't want to do, the assumptions of who I am if I don't do those things, or, like, how progressive I am if I don't do those things. So even progressiveness being seen in, like, a Western white kind of lens, because your idea of progressive is not the same as my idea of progressive. And then on top of that, just, like, not really feeling involved. And then we go into white feminism and microaggressions, and, like, when a lot of white women who I work with say things that are perhaps a bit racially problematic, maybe a bit racist, maybe they've assumed something about me based on, like, what I look like, and I correct them, then I'm also gaslit and being called aggressive, right? Like, I get that, or, like, you get a response that implies that you are overstepping boundaries by correcting them, and it's like, but you're talking about me and my people. Like, it's my responsibility to correct you. You know, I had an experience maybe last year with somebody that I was working with, and they wrote an article, and it kind of, the article had a line in it, just like a sentence that implied a racist stereotype. And it was just, it was something about, like, you know, Africa just being violent or something like that. And I was like, hey, like, I read your article because we worked together, and I was like, that is really cool, but I just feel like this line is a bit weird because, like, you know, I don't really like the implication that, like, Africa is just a violent country. Like, that's a bit racist, right? That's, you know, you're not really dismantling the colonial ideas behind that. Therefore, without that context, it's actually a bit racist. And then she was like, well, that's my opinion. It's my article. So back off. Like, you're just overstepping kind of thing. And I was like, I'm just trying to help you not be racist, sis. Like, and so there's a real assumption of, like, yeah, we love having a Muslim woman on the team. Wow, we're so diverse. But if you come in here and disrupt the status quo, you're out.
Yeah.
It's like, it's really tokenistic, right?
Yeah. And that is the thing, is the word representation, putting it in quotation, you know, you are constantly a representative, like, you are representing something. You, as, you know, someone who, you know, I guess both Tolihan and I are the ticker of boxes. So if you want to talk about organizations, you know, you kind of want to fill in, and let's be honest about this. Organizations have quotas that they do want to fill, and sometimes it's almost like by just having, you know, those boxes ticked, I've got someone who's a woman in her 30s, she's Muslim, she's brown, you know, it's like those are the kind of things that I tick. And you know, I, to be honest, like, I I have to say this, like in terms of my own personal experience, I haven't felt a personal attack to me, but I can see how those things do come about, you know, especially when people are actually just doing it as a tokenism. It's really, really a tokenism. And then when you actually do want to, you know, challenge the status quo and be like, hey, the one thing that I always find is that it's always a joke, right? It's always a joke. It's a banter. Everyone's having a banter.
See, I can't take a joke, apparently.
Yeah. And I'm
what
like,
are jokes? I don't know.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, it's not funny to me. You know, it's not funny to me when you're, you know, making statements, you know, offhanded, being like, oh, you know, bloody Muslim terrorists. I'm like, that's not okay, you know.
When
you,
wow.
If you say that in front of me, I am gonna be like, okay, well, there are 1 to 100 things that's wrong with your statement, and I will pull you up on it, and I will talk to you about it. I don't appreciate them being called aggressive, especially if I haven't in any way raised my voice, you know, but actually just correcting you. And it's always that, oh, I was just joking, you know, it was just a bit of banter, you know, like have a bit of a thicker skin. Don't feel like it's you know, the best one that I love, because I don't wear a hijab, is I'm not talking about you. You're okay. You know,
oh, no.
I always get that. And I'm like, well, you are like, you are talking about my community.
Yeah. So you're not like other Muslims. You're all right. You're okay. You're like, different.
You know, you're okay. Like, you know, you don't have,
I mean, these. I get that too. And it's not even like because I wear a hijab, but it's more just like, because I'm like, yeah, I'll hang out with the squad. I'll hang out with the boys. You know, I'm not like, oh, sorry, I can't speak to men. And because they think that's what Muslim women are like, they just like think you're like one of them. You're like normal, quote unquote. So when they like say things about the Muslim community, it's like, but not you, because you're like Australian. You're like a whitewashed. You're like, you know, you're like us. And I'm just like, I don't think you, like, do you know Muslim people? Because there's so many like me. I literally grew up in like a community. Like, I'm definitely like, I couldn't have become this way randomly. Like, and I really love what you said about like, aggressive and thick skin. It makes me laugh because, first of all, I'm 5'2". Like, there's no way I could be aggressive towards you guys. Like, I'm so small, and like, I'm younger. I'm usually like anywhere between 5 to 10 years younger than the other people around me as well. So it's always like, I think it really shows just how threatened people get when you bring up their racism, because it's immediate gaslighting, right? It's immediate, like when you call out somebody for being racist, it's immediately like, wow, you're so aggressive, you can't take a joke, you know, like, this is the real world. You're just like stuck in your social justice warrior work bubble or whatever. It's like immediate gaslighting that like comes in here to convince you that you've done the wrong thing, that you've misread the situation, when you know you haven't. Like, you absolutely know that you haven't. I'm sorry, but we have enough experience with Muslim women in the world to know when somebody's making a racist joke or not. And it's just like, it's crazy how much people will convince you that you are the problem for disrupting the situation. Mm. I talk about this a lot in my podcast episode, which is like the tactics. Because in my experience, it's actually often white women that do that to me in particular. I think a lot of the issues that I have faced with being, like, I guess, racially gaslit is actually from, like, white feminists, quote unquote, because it'll be, like, a white woman that, like, thinks they're, like, really, you know, progressive or, like, quote unquote, woke, like, feminist, whatever, but they're actually holding quite a few problematic views. And then when you come in there and you're like, hey, like, that's actually a bit racist, that's actually, like, you can't really say that. It's like they take it into a personal attack of their brand, because you can't come in here and call them racist when their brand is feminism, you know? Like, you can't come in here and, like, ruin that image that they're selling. And so you're immediately gaslit into being a bully. Oh, my God, do you know how many times I've been called a bully? I once got trolled for a week and called a bully and everything because I told a white woman to Google something. Like, that was all I did. And I did it politely as well. I had the heart emojis and shit. Like, I was, like, talking about, I don't know if you guys, yeah, I was trying to be nice because I know that people immediately read me as aggressive. People are immediately reading me as aggressive. I constantly have to navigate that. I constantly have to compensate for it by being cute and nice to people, because I can't say anything without the default being aggressive. If I disagree with somebody, it's immediately aggressive, always. Like, that's just how people read me, which is really frustrating. It's just racist. But, you know, I was, like, having a discussion about a few months ago. I don't know if you guys remember those two black teenagers that were, like, doxxed by the media. And I was having a conversation about, like, the racial implications of that because, like, they were the only two COVID patients whose names are released, and they were two black women. And they were the only from, like, many, many, many Australian COVID patients who had broken rules and restrictions. They were the only two that were outed. So we were having, like, quite a nuanced, interesting, like, discussion about the racism that is so pervasive in the media. And somebody just, like, derailed the entire... We were, like, rabbit-holing. And somebody derailed the entire conversation to be, like, what's doxing? And it's, like, are you really going to expect me to backtrack, like, so far now to explain this to you? Like, there's a real entitlement to my time that I think a lot of white women, like, feel like they can have, which frustrates me a lot because, like, I'm not about to dial down, like, my intelligence. I'm not about to dumb myself down for you, especially when, like, you've come into a situation where we're already talking. You know, like, we've already been talking for a long time, and then somebody comes into the conversation and says, oh, what's this? And it's like, I don't really have time to explain that to you. Like, so it's just like somebody replied to that person anyway and explained it to them. And then I kind of was just like, hey guys, like, if you're going to come in a bit later, like, please, like, make an effort to do your Googles before you, like, join a conversation. It just makes it easier for the rest of us. And then just, like, shit blew up and I was, like, called a bully. And it's, why can't you just help her? And it's like, do you know how many people ask me questions like that every day? Like, if I took the time to stop and answer every single question that I had ever received, I would never get anything done, right? And there's a real, real entitlement, and this is in the workplace and everywhere, but, like, just everywhere for me, is an entitlement to my time. People assume that I'm here to explain basic things to them. Like, and this is almost always for me from white women, which is really, really interesting because I think a lot of us assume that our biggest oppressors are white men, and maybe in a lot of ways they are. But for me, the like, actual, like, genuine interactions, like one-on-one interactions I've had that have, like, really upset me have been from white women because they expect shit from me that I don't normally do for people. They expect me to go out of my way to serve them, answer their questions, do a write-up on an issue for free. And people will be like, hey, can you explain this to me? And they'll DM me, and it's something you could Google. And it's, like, a long issue that would take me hours to, like, actually, like, I get paid to write articles. I'm not going to come in here and write you a free one in the DMs, you know, like, and if I'm like, hey, sorry, I'm pretty busy, like, I don't really have time, but, like, you know, maybe check out this resource. It's like, wow, I can't believe you wouldn't do that for me. Like, you know what? You're just a bully. Like, you know what? Like, you're just so fake. Like, I can't believe you wouldn't help me with this. And it's just like, I have, like, a job, guys. Like, there's so much entitlement to my time. And if I, like, even vaguely stand up for myself and say, hey, like, I actually don't really have the time to do this, it's like I'm just a horrible person who's just unhelpful now. And it happens at work too. I feel like there's such a, because I might be knowledgeable about my own experiences as a Muslim woman, suddenly I'm everybody's encyclopedia on it. And it's like, there's no understanding of the emotional labor that comes with having to talk about my life experiences with racism to you 24/7. It's different if we've set out a time, we've got a project that we're working on where this is relevant that I've volunteered to do. But you'd be amazed how much, like, in random conversation, people just want to know about, like, your traumas. First of all, the assumption that you have traumas, always. This is just an assumption that I have all these traumas because I must as a Muslim woman. But then on top of that, like, an assumption for me to, like, sit down and talk to you about it. I don't know you. Like, there are so many white women who, and then again, like, anytime you have boundaries, anytime you have boundaries to protect yourself, you're met with, like, anger and, like, you're guilted for not wanting to, like, share everything with everybody all the time. And it's like, how, you would never ask this of, like, other women. Like, imagine if you went up to, like, a white woman who, you know, has suffered from, like, domestic violence, or, like, she's been raped, or, like, something has happened to her that's traumatic. And you're like, yeah, so tell me about this thing that happened to you. Like, of course you wouldn't do that. You would approach the situation with sensitivity because you understand that this is something that's hurtful to talk about and has obviously impacted this woman's life. But there is no sensitivity when it comes to talking to women of color, and particularly Muslim women. There is no understanding that we are like other people. We have feelings, we have emotions, we have traumas, we're busy, we have shit to do. There is no understanding of any of that. It's like we're supposed to be at everybody's beck and call all the time. We're supposed to perform at 150%, as Soraya said. When we perform at the 99%, for whatever reason, it's deemed an issue. There's never any compassion. Like, I feel like with workplaces, people really need to make an effort to A, be inclusive of us and our boundaries. So if we don't want to drink or don't want to party with you on this level, like, it won't kill you to have a work event where it's just dinner. You know, it really won't kill you to do that every now and then. And then on top of that, like, please stop asking us about racial traumas, because I don't want to talk to you about it. And if I wanted to, I probably would have brought it up myself. Please don't be entitled to our time, because it's not something you would expect from other women. It's just not. Like, I have never had a white female coworker be asked to detail the traumas in her life for, like, because it's interesting. I've never seen that happen. But for me, it's like, I'm just interesting. I'm just like a storybook and not an actual human being with real feelings. Like, people need to humanize us. I feel like I'm constantly dehumanized as just like this otherworldly, like, person, because I am, like, different and I've had these experiences. Like, you know, with last year and the Paragon Hotel thing, for those of you who don't know, I was denied entry into, like, a bar pub thing. In Sydney because of my hijab. That blew up and was all over the news, and I got trolled pretty mercilessly for it. I had to shut down my socials for a while. And it's crazy how many people just, like, run into me and be like, oh my God, yeah, that thing that happened, like, tell me about it. And it's like, I don't want to. I don't want to think about it right now. Like, it's been a year now, so it's different maybe now. But it was like, it was very emotionally distressing time for me. Like, I was scared I was going to get jumped on the street. Like, people were sending me death threats. Like, it's not a cute topic that we're going to talk about over coffee together. Like, it's no. And there's a real lack of understanding of the human element of our lives. You know, during that time, I was asked, like, I did like 7 news interviews in a day, and I was also at work during all of that, so I was, you know, struggling. And then somebody from Channel 10 reached out to me to be on the project for it, and I was like, okay, like, when? And she was like, oh, I can get a team to you in like an hour and a half. And I said no. I was like, and she was like, are you sure? Like, this is a really big opportunity for you. And I was like, I'm sorry, I've done like 7 interviews today. I'm at work. It's like 4 p.m. I'm probably going to cry like any minute now. I really don't have the composure or emotional capacity to like be on the project and like, you know, be composed. Yeah, I was like, I'm sorry, but like, I'm really, I was like to her, if you want to do it tomorrow when I've had a good night's sleep and a cup of tea, I'll do it. There's no way I can do this in an hour. I just like, I can't, I'm just going to cry on TV. Like, it's just, I can't do it. Aww. And she was like, and then she just like paused for a minute, the woman that I was talking to, and she's like, you know what? Like, I've worked in like production for a while, and it's really easy to forget that people, like, these people are not just stories, but they're people. So she was really nice about it. She was like, you know what? I'm so sorry. You're right. Like, I completely forgot that this must actually be a really difficult time for you. At that time, I had just turned 21 and I was still at university. Like, I was, even though it's a year ago, I was definitely much younger. Like, I've done a lot of growing up since then. And so she was nice about it. But I feel like that moment is really important for a lot of people to remember. It's like, us women of color, we are real people with real experiences and real feelings. And it's, you can't just gaslight us or make us feel bad or treat us like that all the time, because we don't exist for your entertainment, for your pleasure, for your work, for your productivity. Like, you don't, like, you got to humanize us like you humanize everybody else.
Sorry to hear you've had those experiences and that people are putting pressure on you, and you're only 22. Like, you just, I think one of the things is that you, because you have a voice and you have a strong voice and you have this podcast and you're growing this following, I think people are looking to you as a leader and they're putting all these additional pressures on you to have all the answers. And that's a lot for you to carry, particularly as you're so young. I think you do a really amazing job of holding yourself and sticking up for yourself as well. So yeah, I hope it doesn't get you down too much.
It doesn't now. I feel like I used to struggle a little bit before, but I've like really developed a good support system now. And also, I didn't have my podcast and stuff then before, and I think the podcast has been good for me because it's really connected me to a lot of people that I perhaps didn't know too well before, because I've had so many women reach out to me and be like, oh my God, I get you. And it's helped me develop a community of women that are just like me, which I didn't have previously. So I think before it was really hard because it's easy to feel quite alone, you know. Well, like, even like maybe my partner and my friends get me, but it's really easy to feel like you're just a number or you're just a story to other people. Yeah. You know, you're just what you produce. You're not really a person yourself. You're just your productivity. But I feel like now, because I've like really worked on like the podcast, it's just been a really positive project for me, because it's not like something that I really like make money off or like do as like something that I've monetized. It's just something I do with my partner, and it was a good way for me to like, I guess, express myself in a way that was like comfortable and organized and like, you know, controlled. And because of that, it actually was really, really great for me. So it helped me, A, articulate a lot of my problems that I maybe hadn't articulated well before. Because by talking about it in a podcast and by having those conversations publicly, it's really helped me pinpoint a lot of issues. And also, I think maybe a few people that had treated me that way before, heard it, and then maybe for them it was like, oh, didn't realize I was doing that. I didn't realize how problematic my behavior was. And so it's been kind of good for, I think, a lot of people to like hear it, recognize their behavior and like change. Because I mean, there's nothing I love more than people like being criticized and like not getting defensive, but actually just like taking it on board and being like, you know what, like I'm really sorry that that did, like I didn't, maybe you didn't mean to do that, because I imagine a lot of people don't, but just because you don't mean to like oppress somebody doesn't mean you don't do it. And you know, when we talk about white feminism and like correcting especially white women, but in general people who are like racist towards you and stuff, like the correct response is to just listen to you and then change your behavior. It's not being like, well, you know what, I didn't intend to be racist, therefore this is not a problem and you're just overreacting. Like, your intention doesn't mean anything. It's about impact. Mm-hmm. As a Muslim brown woman, if I think you're being racist, it's your job to listen to me and to be like, okay, what exactly, okay, cool, like I'm listening to you, I'll adjust my behavior. It really takes nothing. It takes nothing to just like listen to us, be on board with what we say, take us seriously, and then shift your behavior. I think it's really important in workplaces as well, because we're often, I think that's where we probably experience most of our gaslighting and microaggression. That's probably where we are like in a situation where people just like don't take us seriously the most. And a lot of us would feel the pressure to assimilate or to just be quiet or to not be a problem, to not disrupt anything, because you don't want to be labeled as the angry brown woman, right? I don't want to be labeled as the aggressive bully. People got to listen to us.
Yeah. I'd really love to get some insights from you on how workplaces and business owners and white women can support women of colour so that we are seeing diversity in our leadership. Because, you know, we talk about women in leadership and there's like 9 female CEOs in Australia's top 200 companies. None of them are women of colour. And how can we drive change is the question I pose to you first, Soraya, and then to you, Saliha.
Gosh, it's a very big question, isn't it?
Big question, yeah.
And it's something that I think it's something part of my journey as well. You know, I joined She Mentors because I wanted to actually learn to become a better leader. You know, after leaving the UK, like I knew what I didn't want to be, but I didn't know what I wanted to be. And I think part of that is that because I have so many different cultural and other parts of me that I wanted to kind of be part of my identity. So when I joined, you know, She Mentors and kind of start speaking, you know, with all these different women, and just, I've been kind of absorbing, I guess it's kind of my main thing that I've been doing is absorbing a lot of the information and then kind of picking at it. And what I've been finding is that there are some things that I really cannot relate to. You know, there are just some things that I'm just like, okay, well, that's not kind of my experience. These are my experience. These boundaries can be broken, but these are the boundaries that I can't break because of the certain cultural barriers that, you know, I want to be able to protect myself and self-preservation as well. You know, there's a lot of that kind of side of it. So I've had to kind of pick and choose. So I guess, you know, with in terms of organizations, you know, especially I think for people who are in the leadership space and who are coaching people to be leaders, is to kind of be aware of those things and actually have the conversations with people. You know, don't just, because I find that a lot of things are very scripted, you know, that there is a certain kind of formula that people are using when they're talking about leadership, you know, when they're talking about leadership movements or how to become a better leader or how to, you know, lead a business or how to run your own business. There's a certain script and a certain formula to it that's very, it's not rigid, but it is very much like things like be more assertive, you know, communicate well. You got to remember, for people who, you know, while Soraya and I are, you know, we are articulated, much to people's surprise sometimes. You know, there are people who are in this space who are, you know, immigrant women especially. And I think speaking to, you know, a couple of our masterminds, Ali, you know, when we've been talking about a couple of the things that people actually find quite difficult is that I want to be more assertive and I want to be able to communicate more, but people are making fun of my accent. You know, when I have accents, and even though I'm, you know, English is my second language, or sometimes I mix up some words. And people are actually, they're not taking me seriously because I have an accent. And to be perfectly honest, I've never actually kind of clicked on that until recently, you know, and it's something that I've actually backed to my mum, because my mum was someone who, you know, wanted to kind of be part of the community, wanting to make more of that stuff. But she always held back in speaking out because she has an accent. She has, you know, then she feels that she can probably speak it the way that, you know, people, how it should be represented. So I guess when you're wanting to kind of drive change, you know, be aware of those nuances, be part of that conversation, and, you know, stop stereotyping, like really, really stop stereotyping, stop putting it out, you know, kind of like, and when you are called on it, which is a great thing that Saliha made, when you are being called out, fix it, you know, actually fix it, actually go and yep, you know, that is the situation. I'm not here just to be, you know, just to have a token, just to have a representation. I'm actually here to actually make things better. You know, what can I do to kind of, you know, be part of that conversation and actually do that? And definitely actually use the people you have in your organization. Don't just like, you know, be like, I'm going to make, in any leader, right? We will always say this. Involve the people that you work with. Don't just be like, I'm going to make these changes and this is my way of doing things, because you're never going to get people on board to doing that. And you're going to have problems where people are choosing not to go and work for an organization because they just feel like they're going to be a token. They just feel like they're going to be someone who's going to be ticking those boxes, and they refuse to go into the organization when, you know, we shouldn't want to not want to be part of something because you feel like you're going to be singled out. That, you know, that should never happen. Yeah, I hope that makes sense. Sorry.
No, I have a few things to say, but I'm going to jump off what you said just before about like including us. But I wanted to mention with like jobs, I feel like a lot of businesses, because like for me, we're like, yeah, I don't want to work for somewhere that will tokenize me. So I really liked what you said, because I have actively not applied to roles that are available that I know I'm qualified for, because I look at the company and I'm like, I know you have a majority white team. I know I'm going to be the minority there, and I know I'm going to be tokenized there, and I know no one's going to listen to me or respect my boundaries or respect my opinions. So I'm not going to bother. I spoke to a bunch of uni students recently that were doing a project for UTS about the lack of diversity in media publications. And they spoke to a very popular publication that's quite progressive and left-wing, and asked them about like the lack of diversity. Because for a publication that frequently talks about diversity, their staff team is almost all white. And so they asked them about it, and they were like, hey, what's going on there? And the publication said, oh, like, you know, it's not that we don't want to hire people of color, they just don't apply. This really bothers me, because as a business owner, as an editor, as whoever's job it is to hire people, it is your job to find us, right? Like, of course we're not applying because you don't seem like a welcoming business. Like, if you don't know how to change your welcome business, reach out to us. And I know it's not hard, because like I work in media and I like frequently source writers that are people of color. It just takes a quick like Twitter look up. All you have to do is find other similar articles, look at who wrote them, look at their network. Like, it actually doesn't require that much research to find the people that you're looking for. But like, bosses and business owners don't want to do that, in my experience at least. Like, they put the onus of representation onto us. It's not our job to increase representation. It's your job as a business owner, as a boss. It is your job to hire the right people. It is your job to find the right people to hire. It is your job to cultivate a space that is inclusive. And if you've currently got an all-white team or mostly white team and you're like, I don't know what to do, find us, reach out to us, message us, and tell us, A, why you want us on your team, or why like you're interested in it, and B, how you're going to make that team inclusive. Don't just be like, oh, we'd love to have another, you know, we want to diversify our team. Okay, but to what end? Because like, I want to join a team that I know is going to listen to me. I want to have a boss that I know actually cares about my certain circumstances and my different lifestyle and different opinions to everybody else. You know, with my boss at the moment, I really respect how much he really tries to include my needs. Like, he's so flexible, because like, especially around Ramadan and Eid, like, he changed my office hours. So I was starting at 6 a.m. instead, because I was already up at 4 a.m. for Ramadan. So then I got to finish at like 2 or 3, and then I could be home by the time I was going to break my fast and eat. And he was like super understanding about it, and like made an effort to shift my work life so that it would like cater to my needs in Ramadan. And he was like super understanding about the fact that, yeah, probably I'm not working to my 100% right now. I'm like dehydrated and hungry and I'm hangry. And he's like super understanding about it. You know, with Eid, like, I don't know what day Eid is going to be till like the night before. So my availability is a little bit crazy that week. Super understanding about it. Like, yep, just let me know when you know and we'll sort it out. Like, really helpful. I also want to mention pay us because like we mentioned before, with the pay gap, people of color and women of color particularly are paid less pretty much everywhere. I think a lot of businesses know that we're a bit insecure or know that we or will try and make us feel lucky to be of our minority and have an opportunity, and then because we're so lucky they'll pay us less, but we should be grateful for it. Pay us the same as you would pay anybody else. Pay us more even, because we're actually going to go through more shit to be in your position than everybody else is. You know, like, I've definitely gotten pay rises that I've requested and fought for certain things, because I'm like, you don't understand that I'm putting myself like in a situation of like opening myself up to criticism and trolls for you to be talking about these things. So like, compensate us for our emotional labor. Understand that our emotional labor is worth something, you know. Like, I find that people will be like, oh, well, like, why should I pay you extra to talk about things that I don't pay my other staff? And it's like, because none of your other staff are talking about their traumas to you. Like, value our emotional labor, pay us for it. And by paying us for it, we're going to go and tell all our POC friends that you paid us, and they're all going to come and apply for your position. I've like sourced so many writers for the publication that I work for, because I'm like, oh, I know that you'll get paid this amount, because I got paid that amount and you can ask for it. And they're like, oh, good. The word of mouth works. So if you start to be nice to us, you start to treat us well, you start to include us, you look for us, you offer us pay that we deserve, like, word of mouth will spread and you will get the diverse team that you're looking for. But like, also don't, it shouldn't just be about diversity. Like, don't just pigeonhole us as your niche diverse writer. Something I really struggle with is that as a freelance writer, a lot of publications will only reach out to me to write about something when it's specific to my race. Or my identity as a Muslim woman. And it's like, I can write you a listicle on the Marvel movies if you want. Like, I can write about anything because I'm a real person with real interests that aren't limited to my cultural identity. Like, don't pigeonhole us. Let us talk about anything. Like, you know, I'm currently working on a project with somebody where they're trying to start a publication that is just for people of color writers, because we're so sick of being pigeonholed as like niche writers. I'm a niche writer. Like, my experiences in race are not even niche, first of all, because there's millions of people that have experienced the same thing. But even then, like, I get pigeonholed into, okay, Saliha only writes about race and feminism. And while I like writing about those things, I can write with you about anything. I can write you a review on whatever movie came out. I can write to you about the books I like to read. I can write you a breaking up or friendship article. I have, like, otherworldly experiences that aren't just about, like, my race and gender, you know? So I guess that's kind of my main things. Is like, first of all, don't put the burden of representation and diversity on us as, like, employees. It's the bosses or, like, HR's job to do that. And it's not fair how much we have to pick up the slack for companies who don't want to actually do the work to be diverse. So they'll just, like, hire an ethnically diverse person and make it their job, you know, which really frustrates me. So don't do that. Pay us, don't pigeonhole us. And also just, like, include us in the decision-making process. If you treat us like good employees, you will inherently start to get more employees like us. If you make your workplace comfortable for us and you're understanding with us and you talk to us and you listen to us, the word will spread and it'll diversify itself.
I love it. I think that's a thing to, like, you know, is being comfortable in your workplace. You know, when you do have an accent, when you know you may be your writing is, you know, not kind of 100%, you know, especially kind of in my corporate world, like, and also when you have a name that, you know, might not be hard to pronounce, like, please.
Oh my God, yes.
Yes.
Please. I actually want to comment that. Stop nicknaming us.
Yes.
Because I have a lot of people being like, oh, like, that's a bit hard. Can I just call you, you know, XYZ, whatever short version? And I'm just like, no.
That's not my name.
Y'all know how to pronounce Arnold Schwarzenegger. You can pronounce Saliha, you know, like, and that is just another way that, you know, like, companies make us feel uncomfortable and unwelcome. Like, you won't even bother to learn our name. How can I expect you to actually respect me as a staff member? You know, yeah. It's just like, that's an example of a microaggression. I reckon people should really look up microaggressions, because you can find a lot of lists online on just like common microaggressions in the workplace. And I guarantee you, we've experienced all of them. Be it your name, be it, oh, how cute. Like, for me, my partner is white. You know, you have no idea the amount of, like, just coworkers, people that I know, like, when they meet him at a work party or something, are like, oh my God, how did your parents react? Like, what do your parents think of him? You know, just like, those are microaggressions, assumptions you've made about us. And now you're expecting me to be like having a story for you, because again, I'm just a storybook of like the crazy Muslim stories of my crazy Muslim family, right? I'm just entertainment for you. Yeah, I feel like people should really look up like and do your research into microaggressions and the really common ones in the workplace, so that when you see them, you recognize them, you can call them out, you can prevent them.
Amazing. Thank you both so much for sharing your experiences and being so open and honest for the She Mentors podcast. We had so many other questions, but we could literally be here all day chatting about this. And I think
yes,
you're so passionate about this, and I love that. So if people want to continue the conversation, they want to follow you, connect with you, do you want to just share the best ways to to reach out to you both?
Sure, you want to go first?
I'm on LinkedIn, so connect with me, Soraya Sultan, on LinkedIn. I'm not in any way kind of big on social media, on Facebook or Instagram. That's kind of private for me at the moment. That's my boundaries. But yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to have the conversations connect with me on LinkedIn.
For me, if you just want to like have a chat, you're interested in something I said, hit me up on Instagram. It's at Saliha Official. I'm sure the She Mentor people will put it up in a description somewhere. Just Saliha Official at Instagram. If you want to have like, if you want to reach out to me on more of a business level, email me, probably actually email my podcast email. It's heresthething@gmail.com, and though is spelled T-H-O. heresthething@gmail.com. That's probably where I do a lot of my business lies in. So email that if you're interested in talking to me from a more professional capacity. But if you just want to have a chat, thought we were talking about was interesting, maybe related to it, hit me up at Saliha Official. I do a lot of random chats on there. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. And Soraya, you're in our membership as well. So for the people who want to book a mentor hour and chat with you about their experiences, that they can also connect with you on there too, which is great.
Absolutely. Thanks, Ali.
No worries. Thanks for having us.
Thank you so much to Soraya and Saliha for that fascinating interview. I'm going to leave their contact details below. Saliha got in touch just afterwards and said that she'd actually said her email wrong. So we are going to put the correct email address underneath in the show notes of this podcast so you can connect with her. Big thank you to both of them. I think it's really important that we have these conversations and we give people the opportunity to share their perspectives and their points of view. So I really loved recording this, and a big thank you to both of our guests. If you're interested in joining She Mentors, Soraya is part of our membership and is available for mentor hours, so you can go over to shementors.com.au and snap up a mentor hour with her. We absolutely love having her in the membership. Okay, catch you next time.